My name is Judy Madison, and I'm here to talk with you about divorce from my perspective and then perhaps from some experiences that you have had directly or indirectly. I like to use some scripture to begin with, and I thought that the most powerful piece that we can use is from the 10th chapter of Mark. And the Pharisees came up in order to test him and asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife?" He answered them, "What did Moses command you?" They said, "Moses allowed a man to write a certificate of divorce and to put her away." But Jesus said to them, "For your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. But from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one. So they are no longer two, but one. What therefore God has joined together, let no one put asunder." This has been a tough piece of scripture for a long time for people, and most especially in the last 20, 25, maybe up to 30 years now. It has caused us more and more conflict. You probably know some of the history of the scripture, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on that, but in the days that Jesus is talking about and in the times that we're talking about the law of Moses, it was completely permissible to write a certificate of divorce based on burned carrots. I mean, one didn't have to have much reason. One could, in fact, divorce one's wife and leave, which was very difficult in the social system of those times, women having no way of surviving. And so Jesus is critical of the Pharisees who are saying, "Is it all right to have a divorce?" And he's saying, "Sure, sure, it's all in the it's all written down there. You go ahead and do that." But that's hardness of heart as far as he's concerned. Let's look at what was intended. It was intended that you stay together, is what Jesus is saying. I have written a book called Divorce, the Pain and the Healing. I never thought really that I would write that book, even when I was in the midst of that divorce process and afterward for some time, because it seemed to me that my experience was unique, that I didn't really want to, unlike myself, I didn't want to air everything. It was more than just my life here. I didn't want to put it all down on paper and have it out there. But it came over a period of time that a lot of people came to me and said, "Haven't you written anything about this yet?" And I said, "No, it's too individual." But then as I was in small groups and we would be talking about our own situations, our separations, our divorces, our struggles with our marriages and so on, I began to realize that there were a lot of people who felt as I did, who were going through the same kinds of struggles. And in fact, it was very helpful to me to know that they were suffering through the same kinds of experiences. So I felt then that there might be a need to put some of that on paper for the benefit of other people. Divorce, the process of divorce is just a roller coaster of emotions. You've probably heard that description before. Gradually things began to take shape and I had some sense, some distance, some understanding of what was going on. That still goes on for me. And I would say now that my son is ready to be married in 6 weeks, some of this comes very much up to the surface again, and I experience some new things now, some new feelings and concerns. I invite you to interrupt if you'd like to, because you may have some thoughts. I've put together a number of the pieces that I've written, and they are somewhat chronological in terms of what I experienced, and they cover a number of the different areas that I experienced, the feelings and the interactions with other people and so on. But I want you, again, to interrupt if you have something that you'd like to ask or offer. Some of you have heard me before, and you will hear, I think, about three of the poems that I used before. Tension. No matter what I'd been doing, it was always when I began to drive back home that my jaw clenched tight. I carried the weight of our relationship clutched in my head, my chest, and my arms. Finally, my teeth began to ache, and my stomach couldn't welcome food. I hurt. My whole body hurt from the tension of trying and trying and trying. My body knew it couldn't be done. I, in fact, did go. I went to the doctor. That stomach pain was concerning me. But I was holding all kinds of emotion in, you know, and my body was paying the price. And so we went into counseling, John and I. John and I had been married at that time 18 years. And we had had difficulties from the very start. And I had worked at changing myself for a long time. I'd gone to counseling for years. But finally then, at that year, we really kind of took hold and really began to work in hopes of saving the marriage. Prior to that, I think we were held together by those two young boys that we had and who we loved dearly. And that was a very important part of our life together. And that hasn't been destroyed. We are still their parents. I was at Holden that year. It was the first time I came, 1980. We had about 10 days apart. That was very good for both of us to do some reflection. It was very difficult for us, as I explained to some of you earlier, that we were a pastor's family. John was a pastor and is still a pastor. And there was that sense of responsibility to congregations and other people, and as well as to ourselves and our kids, that in some ways held us together longer maybe than we might otherwise have stayed together. We had, after all, made a covenant. We promised a covenant in church for better, worse, richer, poorer, sickness, health, until death. We broke the promise. Yet being together was death for both of us. We were no longer healthy. Today we have another chance to live again. Still, it's hard to break a promise. I remember that Ted was confirmed just shortly after we were separated, and that was a sad day. That was a hard day to go to church. And we were together, all of us, but it just felt so empty. And I said to John, "Oh, gosh, we let him down." And John said to me, "We let each other down," which I think was so true. But we promised ourselves that for the children's sake, there were things we would not do. And for one reason or another, we have been able to hold on to that. We promised each other and ourselves that we would try not to undermine each other, and try not to force our parents and kids to take sides. On the whole, I'd say we were successful at that, but it has to be a discussed thing, and it has to be something you decide. Our children accept us as mom, dad, without much qualification. They only want to feel secure, loved by both, rather than forced to choose or support a particular parent's point of view. It's immensely unfair to ask them to judge a parent using a mate's adult standards. Let children love both of the people who created them. For the children's sake, we will not blame or ask them to reject a parent. We are adults. We can cooperate for the children's sake. But our children did what many children do. We told them one Sunday in March, and as I explained to some of you earlier, each one had a separate reaction. First, let me tell you about Michael, who at the time that we told him withdrew and didn't tell his friends, and I think he felt ashamed and offered to move out for a while. He said maybe if he and Ted moved out for a while that we could get our marriage together without them there, blaming himself, you see. It made me terribly sad. I remembered an earlier time, though. We were riding in the car, Mike and I, downtown. "You'll never get a divorce, will you?" my son asked when he was 9. "No," I assured him, but I wasn't sure. I prayed that it would never happen, but it did. He was sad and frightened, suggesting he and his brother move out for a while so that we could work things out. He blamed himself. I told him it wasn't his fault. But then I recall that once I also told him it would never happen. It makes me cry to remember. We let them down. Ted was 13 when it happened, I guess. My older son, 14, called me home whenever I stayed at a friend's too long. It was annoying. I wasn't very late, and I needed time away. But I went home to be with him. Now I've learned that children of divorce fear the added loss of their home parent after the other parent moves away. He needed security to know I would stay. It only lasted for a while, but however long it might have lasted, I'm glad I went home to be with him. I had to read that to even know what was really going on, and it was helpful to read all the material that's out these days on these kinds of things. Ted has now been able to tell me much more about how he has felt about that divorce and how much he kept inside himself, and what Ted did was get himself very busy and active and sort of pushed the feelings he had off to the side. And I regret that, and we've talked that over. But children will react in very many different ways, and our children didn't happen to act out, as we say, in naughty ways. But there's no question in my mind, and I would say this again and again, it's hard on kids, and I will never kid anybody about that. It's not fair to them. They don't deserve it. They do survive it. Some of them grow immensely. Some of them, in some cases, it's a better thing for them because the family is then less in conflict. But it's not easy. And sometimes I was able to put myself in John's place. Obviously, a lot of times this comes from my point of view. It is lonely leaving the children and going home alone. I'm sometimes afraid they'll forget me, lose interest, resent my absence, blame me. I wonder if there's something I should be doing for them. When we're together, it's hard to act naturally. It takes a while to begin to talk. This is an awkward time. Perhaps it's best to talk candidly about it with the children. If each one can say the truth, we can feel closer and begin to go on. We'll often be separated, but inwardly united, because our shared emotions bind us together. I do think we're afraid to talk directly to our kids about these things, about what's going on. And that's an important thing, would be helpful. A woman told me not terribly long ago, in this case she was the one who left the family for a while. She said she had this sense that she had to provide something really special for them when she did see them. Now, some mothers look at that when the dads move out as being the Disneyland dad syndrome, where he comes in and kind of gives the kids a good time, and mom never gets to really have that fun. She gets to be the parent, the one who corrects them and who has to keep the house running and kind of the bad person in the group. And dad comes in and everybody has fun and he looks like the better person. So mothers worry about that. Well, here was a mother saying the reason that she came in and wanted to provide that kind of entertainment was she was afraid if she didn't do enough, the kids wouldn't want to see her again. So here are parents working on their own sense of rejection from each other and then from their kids too. There are many lifestyle changes, of course, that come with divorce. And that financial one is real important. The fact is there's less money now. Everyone lives with less and wonders more. It's an added irritation to an otherwise perplexing time. Blame and greed set in, and I find myself envying not only you, that would be a reference to my former husband, not only you, but friends and strangers who are not so troubled. It's no wonder Jesus spoke so often about money. We're accustomed to having what we want, and now we must temper even our wishes for what we want. I turn to friends to get perspective, to the Gospel of Luke, and to God. I feel I have to say to you that when I say, and when I'm using the word you, I'm usually referring to the partner, but it doesn't necessarily mean it was John Madison that I'm talking about. I'm writing, trying to write from many people's perspective. I'm sick of change. Now, I said that one day driving down the freeway on my way to the seminary. Shortly after the divorce, or shortly after the separation, I started going to seminary. And I was working 30 hours a week, and I was taking a full load at seminary. And I hated Greek, and it was just terrible. And one day I just yelled in the car, "I'm sick of change." I was sick of it. New ways of managing money, of repairing machines, washing clothes, eating dinners. New experiences meeting people, entering places alone, looking for someone to talk to, wondering what happened to old friends. New view of myself, how I've been insensitive. Discovering untapped talents, thinking of myself as single, surprising myself with emotions. Life is so unfamiliar at times, and I get tired of adjusting, readjusting, thinking about myself and my life. I long for familiar routine. Change is exhausting, yet exhilarating. I pause to wonder, who would I have been without this change? I'm tired, but it's worth the discovery. I was telling one of the Holden people yesterday that I was proud of myself for cleaning the drain in the chalet where I'm staying, and that one of the things I've learned is how to open up that trap underneath the sink, you know, and clean it out. Well, I would never have bothered to do that before. Well, maybe, but no, I probably wouldn't have. I can tell by the way they say single, people feel sorry for me. Some of them promise, "You'll find someone again." Others tease, "Have you met any nice person yet?" There is implicit in their words an idea that marriage is better and single is less than. It makes me wonder how always single people feel in a coupled society. I wonder how much the expectations of people having to be married influenced my decision to marry and confused my thoughts about divorce. I'm still a whole person. I still like basketball and reading and snow and dinners out and children, sunshine, and my work. I'm not less than. I'm me. Single is not inadequate. It's like all of life. Bittersweet and good and rich and full of God, sadness and promise and fear. People need not feel sorry for me. But that is an adjustment one makes when you're used to being related to someone else. And when you're a woman, you know, a lot of times, it's changing a little, but a lot of times you're thought of as the other arm on somebody else. I think about how many women are called Mrs. Henry such and such. You know, and I've always wondered, well, who is she? What's her name? What did they name her when she was born? She isn't Henry, I know that. And that is a real adjustment for her then, if she's been Mrs. Henry all these years. It's a real adjustment to become Christine or whatever. We used to go to parties, crowds of people standing around talking, laughing. Whenever I got bored or irritated or tired, I could just ease myself across the room to stand beside you. I didn't have to say a word. I could just stand there because we belong together, a unit. Now I'm alone. I have to make the effort to leave the boredom or change the conversation, to meet new people, or speak to the hostess about leaving. I cannot depend on someone else to be my social avenue. I've met a lot of interesting people. Independence helps me grow. When we were two, we went about together, parties, dinner at friends, coffee with neighbors. Now that I'm one, I wonder, are the parties still happening? The dinners, have they stopped? I set myself to inviting folks in, couples, singles, old friends, new. People forget when we aren't two that you and I are still whole. We have interests and talents and enjoy laughing among friends just as we used to, except not as a couple anymore. This is a coupled society, 2, 4, 6, 8. It's hard to be 3, 5, and 7. And it's really true, and I decided I would invite people in. You can't just sit around and hope that people are going to take care of you all the time, you know? And so I would do that. It didn't work. It didn't happen to work. But I am very grateful for the many friends. I've been three a lot. I've been the third one in a group often, and sometimes the fifth. And it's really wonderful when married people are sensitive to that need. And I would encourage you, if you are a married person, to think about the widow or the widower or the divorced person that you know, or the single person that you know, who would like to be included in your activity. They have a lot to offer, a lot to say, interesting people. I learned a lot about myself through this process, particularly in terms of emotions. As I told you, it was just a roller coaster, and that's the word many people use. And one day you feel so great, and the next day you cannot believe that you're in the pits. And anger was one of the things that I just had to come to terms with. I had always been successfully able to bury my anger, which was part of the problem, wasn't it? And turned it nicely into resentments instead. But the other thing was that I've been a person, I'll even still smile when I'm angry, that incongruent thing to do. And here I was in a situation where I had to take a good look at the fact that I was very angry. I am sometimes amazed at my anger. Whatever has gone before, I'm surprised to find so much residue of hostility and anger now. It's a sign of the investment I've made in your behavior and welfare, and how it is so entangled with mine. I'm glad for friends who hear me out, and for the one who gave me that pillow to hit. I remember with relief the anger of Jesus and David and Moses. I can try to pretend it isn't in me, but it comes seeping out one way or another. Let it go. Don't injure. Don't deny. Separation and divorce are full of anger. And there are, in a couple, if you've lived together for a while, you all know each other's vulnerability. You know which thing hooks somebody. It's not even conscious anymore. And so when John and I would talk on the phone, we both would do that to each other, not even know why the other would be suddenly so furious. And that's very hard. You know, when you're not together, the irony of it all is that when you're not together, it's even worse in a sense because you can't work anything out. So that part of that transition is coming to terms with the fact that that's why you got divorced, because you don't want to have to keep trying to work things out. So let it go. But it's hard to let it go because we all like to win if we can't resolve things. We meet on the street by chance, once legally related, now related only by the past memories, struggles, laughter, and the confidence of trust that comes with years of being family together. We laugh again, talk, quickly share news, and promise to have lunch. Then you are gone and I sigh. Loss. It will never be the same again. And that still touches me. And I know that it will be hard to be at the wedding. There will be that mixture of feelings, that confusion that goes with that, because I was married to this man for 18 years, 19 years. I still know him. And in fact, I think sometimes the anger that comes up in some couples, you see some couples who cannot let go of the anger. I sometimes think it is because they were so deeply involved. They were so entangled, and in a positive way at some point, so in love. That the only way to distance themselves from that loss is with anger. And I did notice that as we were parting in those last few weeks, John and I were never this way, typically, but we got very irritable, picky at each other. It was like we were picking fights. And finally I said to him, you know, I think we're doing this so that it doesn't hurt so bad to leave. But I said, I don't think it's very good for the kids. So we stopped. I don't know. Maybe it wasn't honest, but we did sort of ease off then. I suppose we just distanced ourselves from each other, just didn't spend that much time close together. Another irony is that no matter how it comes about, everybody feels rejected. It is triggered at times by music. Some days it comes when I watch another couple, young or old, walking hand in hand and sharing together. It stings. I feel rejected. I had as much to do with this choice as you, yet I cannot help but feel I am less, inadequate to your needs. You have left me, and I feel alone and rejected. Finding someone else to fill the hollow is a temporary solution. I must live with and overcome rejection so that I may begin again. And again, I say to you, I have as much to do with this as anyone, but we both would felt rejected. And I think if we're sensitive, I argue with myself. It was my fault. No, I'm not to blame. Yes, I am. I could have done this. I should have been that. Maybe I just didn't try hard enough, long enough. And I sigh. I can't relive the past, nor find a simple route through a maze of life experiences, as if there's an easy answer to what happened to us. When I'm tired or prone to doubt, I blame myself, the easy way out. It is self-recrimination, self-destruction, and it keeps me from going on. I have a sense that this one was written from a male perspective. I've always been quite capable, trying new things, reasoning my way through life with relative success. This has been a shock. I can't reason my way through a dismantled relationship. Sometimes I don't understand what caused everything to fall apart. I can't seem to cope in my usual ways, working hard, persisting, thinking it through, persuading. I'm left on an open plain where I must walk for miles before I see any rise or trees or home. I must find new ways of looking at life and myself. God is at work in this somehow. Help me find my way. That finding new ways of looking at life and ourselves usually requires a third person. I just think that people before and after divorce need to be in counseling, period. And I don't think pastors have enough time to do all that needs to be done in that area. We try. But it seems to me that there's a lot to think about and a lot to learn from this experience, and one would hope that people get some counseling. Ironically, again, that's when you don't have the money. But you need to invest in your own well-being, too. Sometimes I'm lonely. It can happen on Sunday afternoon, Saturday night, or even in the middle of a crowd. What matters is what I do. It's not always necessary to run away from loneliness. Busy, busy, meet the gang, go to a movie, call a friend. Sometimes I just wait a while and it passes. Loneliness is part of any life. Other times it's important to move out of my lethargy and find company. Self-pity is useless and tiring, and there are people waiting for my phone call or letter or a visit for an hour. Loneliness is not an enemy, but a moment to be lived. I have discovered myself as I meet loneliness and use it to learn about life. It's not an enemy. I had to come to terms with that. Sometimes I still find it feels like an enemy. And I think that I have learned to trust that if I wait just a little while, it goes away. That is, in fact, an emotion, and emotions change. Finally, one of the things that was most important in this whole process for me was what I learned about relationships. Sometimes people do not realize how important it is to have a hug. I don't need passion, certainly not every day, but a hug or a knowing hand clasp, even a kind word spoken with tenderness, warms me and leaves me feeling whole again. We're like babies, really. Babies need swaddling clothes, blankets wrapped firmly around them to feel secure, as they felt before birth. We need holding, hugs, the security of love in order to have new birth. Thank God for people who touch in love. I think about widows when I think about this one in particular, who miss just the closeness of other people. People wait for me to speak of the divorce. For a long while, I thought it was their judgment that kept them silent. Then I realized it was their love, which didn't want to accentuate my pain. I spoke first. Not a constant rehash of the past or whining about the present, but an honest statement of how I felt, lonely, excited, confused, relieved, and even now and then angry. When I could be open, they felt more comfortable asking and talking with me. Our tentative steps formed a trail of support which we could walk together. If you're the other person, maybe you need to feel free to ask, how are you doing? That's a pretty nondescript question, pretty safe. How are you doing this week? How are things going? And that gives someone an opportunity to say the truth. You have to say it so they believe you, you know, that you really want to know.
Amazing.
And I did learn this. I learned this partly in seminary. I find myself reluctant to ask other people for help. A counselor, a sounding board, a hug on Sunday morning, a voice on a quiet night. Sometimes it's because I'm afraid to need people, and afraid to lose someone again. I lift my chin. I argue with myself that I should stand alone. I keep going. Another day, another week. It'll get better eventually. Then one late afternoon I know I can't do it alone. I need someone to stand with me. My fear has robbed me of love, the very thing I hope most to recover as I travel this changing road. Reach out, I tell myself. Tell someone what you need. We aren't created to stand alone. Do you ever do that? Just try to stand alone when you're hurting? We were talking about that in text study this morning a little bit. I think what a Samaritan gift it is for somebody to tell me how they're really feeling about something, because it gives me permission to do the same. And sometimes I find out, oh, my word, they feel the same way I do, and I'm not crazy. It's a wonderful gift. And I have this neighbor who lives about a block away. He's never been to Holden, but he should come. Christmas. A friend stopped by with a gift. It wasn't packaged specially. It was just a message. I give to you 4 hours of my time to teach you how to repair anything you need to fix. A wonderful, thoughtful gift. Washing machine, garage door, stalled car, clogged drain. We've done them all, and I learned how. What is more precious than time from a friend and neighbor? A Christmas gift for all year. Wasn't that a great gift? If I never knew before, I understand church now. Church is the group of people standing together at coffee, smiling and welcoming me. Church is a cluster of friends, separated, divorced, widowed, who talk about how we really feel. Church is Tom and Diane, saving me a seat beside them in the pew so I don't always sit alone. Church is the community shaped by the love of Jesus, which embraces all of us, without labels or questions, innuendos or fear. Bless the church, where I am at home, even alone. I remember sitting at the church council meeting the night that I had to tell them. I was working at a church then. And I was real scared. I really was shaky. I could feel myself quaking inside, you know. I hated to tell these people. I didn't know how they would think, what they would think of me, and particularly some people I felt would be judgmental. But it had to be done, and so I told them that John and I were separating. And afterwards, people were great. And the people who came up were some of the ones I feared most would reject me, up with a hug right away to say they still cared. It was absolutely wonderful. And now I had the advantage of being able to, I had a place, you know, where I could do that, where I could tell people in a sort of a formal way, this is what's happening to me. And I think that was helpful. And I think that's what we don't do as divorced people sometimes. We don't put it out there and say, this is who I am, and this is what I'm going through, this is my life. And then those of you who are not in that position need to also inquire in that non-judgmental way, how are you? Or say, I understand things are hard now. I understand that you had a hard time. Yeah.
We have a lady, going back to that Christmas gift you just told about, she had four children, and her husband died not too long ago. And at Christmas time, they asked her, Mom, what do you want for Christmas? And she said, I want to ride to church every Sunday morning from one of you. And you know, she's been in church with some of her family ever since Christmas.
Great idea. A ride to church every Sunday morning with one of her family.
That was her Christmas wish.
Wonderful, wonderful Christmas gift. Someone reminded me that things take time. Emotions must be felt and let go. People must adjust. But we don't adapt overnight. Each new experience, each change, takes its own toll of energy and patience and gradual understanding. 2 years, one person said. I scoffed inside. As 2 years passed by, I realized the wisdom of experience. Things take time to heal. I think I saw the most change at about 4 years. I all of a sudden was able to kind of let go of stuff. It didn't ride with me as quickly, as often anymore. It wasn't part of my being. There was a sense that it had gone out of my body. I think we carry so much in, if we would be in tune with our muscles and the way our bodies react, we carry a lot there. And suddenly it began to go after about 4 years, which was nice. Jesus told us, it is not God's intention that we should divorce. It is God's wish that we should be one, in marriages, internationally, in families, in friendships, even within ourselves, whole, one, and integrated. God wants our happiness. But we have not been able to fulfill God's wish. We have lived lives of strife, misunderstanding, war, pain, and divorce. We have failed. Jesus told us God's intention, but Jesus came because we fail. We divorce and turn for forgiveness and new life to the one who can help us and bring us back to God. So it's painful, but it heals. Over and over, little at a time, with each new year, each time, each new event. And so John and I will be together, sitting in the same row at a wedding on the 13th of August, and be able to say to those kids that we want them to have a happy life together. John is remarried, lives in Billings, and now in the last year he moved there. And it's nice to know that We don't naively say, oh, well, we're good friends. But we can say that we have some mutual respect and that all of the past was not bad. And that that we're new, that we're forgiven people. What kinds of situations have you experienced or have you wondered about? Or we had sort of a joint custody. The children lived with me most of the time. I was so blessed. My parents were gone. I guess my dad hadn't died yet. But I didn't have a family relationship. And so John's parents were very important to me. In fact, part of the reason that I hesitated so long to really pursue the making the marriage work or not work. I knew once I pushed it, it might not work. And so I didn't push for a long time because I hated to lose that family. But John and I again talked that over and said we would not put our parents in the position of choosing sides. And we didn't. And they didn't. And so they have been very loyal. That's lucky. You have other experience? Yeah. And that's very hard. Do you get to see the children?
Yeah.
That's good. Sometimes time makes it better. You see, it's that sense that we have as human beings that when a relationship doesn't work, that somehow a relationship is sort of glued together. You have this person and this person, you glue it together, and then when it doesn't work, you have to decide whether one side was better or the other, rather than seeing relationship as something that meets and mixes together. And then when it doesn't break apart neatly, and there isn't any one person who's responsible for a pattern that fits together like that. I've watched marriages that I think are beginning to fail, and it makes me immensely sad to see them missing each other. That one person is just is looking for acknowledgement from the other at the very moment that that person looks away, and then they reverse the role, and this person looks to do something right, and the other person happens to look away at that moment. Relationships are so carefully entwined with each other. There just isn't one right and wrong way. And I think about young couples, young people, I try to tell them, when they're looking for a mate and they're looking for this perfect person and this relationship, that relationships are very complex. What are those funny puzzles that you have that are round and you can turn them all those funny ways? Cube, yeah. Rubik's cube. You know, it all fits together somehow, but it's not neat and tidy. And what makes a relationship has to do with how you are able to adjust to each other. And has nothing to do with whether one person is good and or wonderful or charming or beautiful or any of that. It has something to do with the way those two spirits work together. Very much less definable. And you know that if you've lived in a marriage and then changed together over the years. It's real complicated stuff. So it's sad when people want to just make it into this person and this person, right and wrong. It's too complicated for that.
Dr. Berninghoff, who married us 50 years ago, talked to us at our golden wedding. And one of the things he said was that he took off his wedding ring and noticed it said 14 karat gold. And he compared that to 14 karat love. If it'd be all gold, it'd be 24 carats and it wouldn't hold up. And then he named the different alloys that were needed for to combine with the gold, make it strong. And also 10 things that had to go into a marriage in order to make it solid and strong. And I'd never heard that analogy before, but it was really apropos.
Good image. Take note, you pastors, for your next marriage sermon. It is hard when people ask, how are the kids doing? Because it does imply guilt. Well, it implies something, I guess, and we take it on as guilt.
Well, I'm saying something more about it.
Life is complicated, Lord, and relationships are not easy or simple, and they change, and we change. Give us that stability that says that you forgive us no matter what happens, and that you understand us and love us. Give us the wherewithal to work at relationships in which we find ourselves, whether they are marriage relationships, family, or friends. Give us your guidance and your strength and your love so that we learn to accept one another as well as accept our failure and go on new each day. We thank you for the love of Jesus, who sustains us and taught us to pray, Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thy kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.